Side 5, Sphere, by Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 191. The First Exchange.
"Well," Ted said finally, "this is not what I expected at all."
"It looks childish," Beth said, "like something out of those old Sea Spot Run readers for kids."
"That's exactly what it looks like."
"Maybe you translated it wrong," Barnes said.
"Certainly not," Harry said.
"Well, this alien sounds like an idiot," Barnes said.
"I doubt very much that he is," Ted said.
"You would doubt it," Barnes said. "A stupid alien would blow your whole theory. But it's something to consider, isn't it? A stupid alien, they must have them."
"I doubt," Ted said, "that anyone in command of such high technology as that sphere is stupid."
"And you haven't noticed all the ninnies driving cars back home," Barnes said. "Jesus, after all this effort, how are you? I am fine. Jesus."
Norman said, "I don't feel that this message implies a lack of intelligence, Hal."
"On the contrary," Harry said, "I think the message is very smart."
"I'm listening," Barnes said.
"The content certainly appears childish," Harry said. "But when you think about it, it's highly logical. A simple message is unambiguous, friendly, and not frightening. It makes a lot of sense to send such a message. I think he's approaching us in the simple way that we might approach a dog. You know, hold out your hand, let it sniff, get used to you."
"You're saying he's treating us like dogs?" Barnes said. Norman thought, Barnes is in over his head. He's irritable because he's frightened. He feels inadequate. Or perhaps he feels he's exceeding his authority.
"No, Hal," Ted said. "He's just starting at a simple level."
"Well, it's simple, all right," Barnes said. "Jesus Christ, we contact an alien from outer space and he says his name is Jerry."
"Let's not jump to conclusions, Hal."
"Maybe he has a last name," Barnes said hopefully. "I mean, my report to SyncCompact is going to say one person died on a deep-sat expedition to meet an alien named Jerry." "It could sound better. Anything but Jerry," Barnes said. "Can we ask him?"
"Ask him what?"
Harry said. "His full name."
Ted said, "I personally feel we should have much more substantive conversations."
"I'd like the full name," Barnes said, "for the report."
"Right," Ted said. "Full name, rank, and serial number."
"I would remind you, Dr. Fielding, that I am in charge here."
Harry said, "The first thing we have to do is see if he'll talk at all. Let's give him the first number grouping." He typed, 0003212522632. There was a pause, then the answer came back. 0003212522632.
"Okay," Harry said. "Jerry's listening." He made some notes on his pad and typed another string of numbers.
0002921, 301321, 0613182108142232.
"What did you say?"
Beth said.
"We are friends," Harry said.
"Forget friends. Ask his damn name," Barnes said.
"Just a minute, one thing at a time," Ted said. "He may not have a last name, you know."
"You can be damn sure," Barnes said, "that his real name isn't Jerry."
The response came back. 0004212232.
He said yes.
"Yes, what?" Barnes said.
"Just yes. Let's see if we can get him to switch over to English characters. It'll be easier if he uses letters and not his number codes."
"How are you going to get him to use letters?"
"We'll show him they're the same," Harry said. He typed,
0003212522632, equal sign, H-E-L-L-O. After a short pause, the screen blinked. 0003212522632, equal sign, H-E-L-L-O.
He doesn't get it, Ted said. No, doesn't look like it. Let's try another pairing. He typed, 0004212232 equal sign, YES. The reply came back, 0004212232 equal sign, YES. He's definitely not getting it, Ted said.
I thought he was so smart, Barnes said.
Give him a chance, Ted said. After all, he's speaking our language, not the other way around.
The other way around, Harry said.
Good idea. Let's try the other way around, see if he'll deduce the equation that way. Harry typed, 0004212232, equal sign, YES, period. YES, period, equal sign, 0004212232.
There was a long pause while they watched the screen. Nothing happened.
Is he thinking? Who knows what he's doing?
Why isn't he answering?
Let's give him a chance, Hal, okay?
The reply finally came. YES, period, equal sign, 0004212232. 23221240000 equal sign, period, S-E-Y.
He thinks we're showing him mirror images.
Stupid, Barnes said. I knew it.
What do we do now? Let's try a more complete statement, Harry said. Give him more to work with.
Harry typed, 0004212232 equal sign, 0004212232 YES, period, equal sign, YES, period. 0004212232 equal sign, YES, period.
A syllogism, Ted said. Very good.
A what? Barnes said.
A logical proposition, Ted said.
The reply came back, comma, equal sign, comma.
What the hell is that? Barnes said.
Harry smiled.
I think he's playing with us.
Playing with us? You call that playing?
Yes, I do, Harry said.
What you really mean is that he's testing us, testing our responses to a pressure situation. Barnes narrowed his eyes. He's only pretending to be stupid.
Maybe he's testing how smart we are, Ted said. Maybe he thinks we're stupid, Hal.
Don't be ridiculous, Barnes said.
No, Harry said. The point is, he's acting like a kid trying to make friends. And when kids try to make friends, they start playing together. Let's try something playful.
Harry sat at the console, typed, equal sign, equal sign, equal sign. The reply quickly came back. Comma, comma, comma.
Cute, Harry said. This guy is very cute.
He quickly typed, equal sign, comma, equal sign. The reply came, 7 ampersand 7. Are you enjoying yourself? Barnes said. Because I don't know what the hell you are doing.
He understands me fine, Harry said.
I'm glad somebody does.
Harry typed, capital P, small p, capital P. The reply came, H-E-L-L-O, period, equal sign,
0003212525263 2.
Okay, Harry said. He's getting bored. Playtime's over. Let's switch to straight English.
Harry typed, YES, period. The reply came back, 0004212232. Harry typed, H-E-L-L-O, period.
There was a pause. Then, I am delighted to make your acquaintance. The pleasure is entirely mine, I assure you.
There was a long silence. Nobody spoke.
Okay, Barnes said finally. Let's get down to business.
He's polite, Ted said. Very friendly.
Unless it's an act. Why should it be an act?
Don't be naive, Barnes said.
Norman looked at the lines on the screen. He had a different reaction from the others. He was surprised to find an expression of emotion.
Did this alien have emotions?
Probably not, he suspected. The flowery, rather archaic words suggested an adopted tone. Jerry was talking like a character from a historical romance.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Harry said, for the first time in human history, you are online with an alien. What do you want to ask him?
His name, Barnes said promptly.
Besides his name, Hal.
There are certainly more profound questions than his name, Ted said.
I don't understand why you won't ask him. The screen printed. Are you the entity H.O. in Mexico?
Jesus, where'd he get that?
Maybe there are things on the ship fabricated in Mexico.
Like what? Chips, maybe.
Are you the entity made in the USA?
The guy doesn't wait for an answer.
Who says he's a guy?
Beth said.
Oh, Beth.
Maybe Jerry is short for Geraldine.
Not now, Beth. Are you the entity made in the USA?
Answer him, Barnes said.
Yes, we are. Who are you?
A long pause, then. We are.
We are what?
Barnes said, staring at the screen. Hal, take it easy.
Harry typed, We are the entities from the USA. Who are you? Entities equals entity.
It's too bad, Ted said, that we have to speak English. How are we going to teach him plurals?
Harry typed, No. You are a many entity?
I see what he's asking. He thinks we may be multiple parts of a single entity.
Well, straighten him out.
No, we are many separate entities.
You can say that again, Beth said.
I understand. Is there one control entity?
Ted started laughing.
Look what he's asking.
I don't get it, Barnes said.
Harry said, He's saying, take me to your leader. He's asking who's in charge.
I'm in charge, Barnes said. You tell him.
Harry typed,
Yes. The control entity is Captain Harold C. Barnes.
I understand.
With an O, Barnes said irritably. Harold with an O.
You want me to retype it?
Never mind. Just ask him who he is.
Who are you?
I am one.
Good, Barnes said. So there's only one. Ask him where he's from.
Where are you from?
I am from a location.
Ask him the name, Barnes said. The name of the location.
Hal, names are confusing.
We have to pin this guy down.
Where is the location you are from?
I am here.
We know that. Ask again.
Where is the location from where you began?
Ted said, That isn't even good English from where you began. It's going to look foolish when we publish this exchange.
We'll clean it up for publication, Barnes said.
But you can't do that, Ted said, horrified. You can't alter this priceless scientific interaction.
Happens all the time. What do you guys call it? Massaging the data.
Harry was typing again.
Where is the location from where you began?
I began at Awareness.
Awareness? Is that a planet or what?
Where is Awareness?
Awareness is.
He's making us look like fools, Barnes said.
Ted said, Let me try.
Harry stepped aside and Ted typed, Did you make a journey?
Yes.
Did you make a journey?
Yes, Ted typed.
I make a journey
You make a journey. We make a journey together. I am happy.
Norman thought, he said he is happy. Another expression of emotion, and this time it didn't seem to come from a book. The statement appeared direct and genuine. Did that mean that the alien had emotions? Or was he just pretending to have them, to be playful, or to make them comfortable? Let's cut the crap, Barnes said. Ask him about his weapons. I doubt he'll understand the concept of weapons. Everybody understands the concept of weapons, Barnes said. Defense is a fact of life.
I must protest that attitude, Ted said. Military people always assume that everyone else is exactly like them. This alien may not have the least conception of weapons or defense. He may come from a world where defense is wholly irrelevant.
Since you're not listening, Barnes said, I'll say it again. Defense is a fact of life. If this Jerry is alive, he'll have a concept of defense.
My God, Ted said. Now you're elevating your idea of defense to a universal life principle. Defense as an inevitable feature of life.
Barnes said, you think it isn't? What do you call a cell membrane? What do you call an immune system? What do you call your skin? What do you call wound healing? Every living creature must maintain the integrity of its physical borders. That's defense. And we can't have life without it. We can't imagine a creature without a limit to its body that it defends. Every living creature knows about defense, I promise you. Now ask him.
I'd say the captain has a point, Beth said. Perhaps, Ted said, but I'm not sure we should introduce concepts that might induce paranoia.
I'm in charge here, Barnes said. The screen printed out. Is your journey now far from your location? Tell him to wait a minute.
Ted typed, please wait, we are talking. Yes, I am also. I am delighted to talk to multiple entities from Made in the USA. I am enjoying this much.
Thank you, Ted typed.
I am pleased to be in contact with your entities. I am happy for talking with you. I am enjoying this much.
Barnes said, let's get offline.
The screen printed, please do not stop. I am enjoying this much.
Norman thought, I'll bet he wants to talk to somebody after 300 years of isolation. Or had it been even longer than that? Had he been floating in space for thousands of years before he was picked up by the spacecraft? This raised a whole series of questions for Norman. If the alien entity had emotions, and he certainly appeared to, then there was the possibility of all sorts of aberrant emotional responses, including neuroses, even psychoses. Most human beings, when placed in isolation, became seriously disturbed rather quickly. This alien intelligence had been isolated for hundreds of years. What had happened to it during that time? Had it become neurotic? Was that why it was childish and demanding now?
Do not stop. I am enjoying this much.
We have to stop, for Christ's sake, Barnes said.
Ted typed, we stop now to talk among our entities.
It is not necessary to stop. I do not care to stop.
Norman thought he detected a petulant, irritable tone. Perhaps even a little imperious. I do not care to stop. This alien sounded like Louis XIV.
It is necessary for us, Ted typed.
I do not wish it.
It is necessary for us, Jerry.
I understand.
The screen went blank. That's better, Barnes said. Now, let's regroup here and formulate a game plan. What do we want to ask this guy?
I think we better acknowledge, Norman said, that he's showing an emotional reaction to our interaction.
Meaning what? Beth said, interested.
I think we need to take the emotional content into account in dealing with him.
You want to psychoanalyze him? Ted said. Put him on the couch, find out why he had an unhappy childhood?
Norman suppressed his anger with some difficulty. Beneath that boyish exterior lies a boy, he thought.
No, Ted, but if Jerry does have emotions,
then we'd better consider the psychological aspects of his response. I don't mean to offend you, Ted said, but personally I don't see that psychology has much to offer. Psychology is not a science. It's a form of superstition or religion. It simply doesn't have any good theories or any hard data to speak of. It's all soft. All this emphasis on emotions, you can say anything about emotions and nobody can prove you wrong. Speaking as an astrophysicist, I don't think emotions are very important. I don't think they matter very much.
Many intellectuals would agree, Norman said.
Yes, well, Ted said, we're dealing with a higher intellect here, aren't we?
In general, Norman said, people who aren't in touch with their emotions tend to think their emotions are unimportant.
You're saying I'm not in touch with my emotions? Ted said.
If you think emotions are unimportant, you're not in touch, no.
Can we have this argument later? Barnes said.
Nothing is, but thinking makes it so, Ted said.
Why don't you just say what you mean, Norman said angrily, and stop quoting other people.
Now you're making a personal attack, Ted said.
Well, at least I haven't denied the validity of your field of study, Norman said, although without much effort I could. Astrophysicists tend to focus on the far-off universe as a way of evading the realities of their own lives. And since nothing in astrophysics can ever be finally proven...
That's absolutely untrue, Ted said.
Enough.
That's enough, Barnes said, slamming his fist on the table. They fell into an awkward silence. Norman was still angry, but he was also embarrassed. Ted got to me, he thought. He finally got to me. And he did it in the simplest possible way, by attacking my field of study. Norman wondered why it had worked. All his life at the university, he'd had to listen to hard scientists, physicists and chemists, explain patiently to him that there was nothing to psychology. While these men went through divorce after divorce, while their wives had affairs, their kids committed suicide or got in trouble with drugs, he'd long ago stopped responding to these arguments. Yet Ted had gotten to him.
Return to the business at hand, Barnes was saying. The question is, what do we want to ask this guy?
What do we want to ask this guy?
They stared at the screen.
Uh-oh, Barnes said.
Uh-oh.
Does that mean what I think it means?
Does that mean what I think it means?
Ted pushed back from the console. He said loudly, Jerry, can you understand what I am saying?
Yes, Ted.
Great, Barnes said, shaking his head. Just great.
I am happy also. Alien negotiations.
Norman, Barnes said. I seem to remember you covered this in your report, didn't you? The possibility that an alien could read our minds.
I mentioned it. Norman said.
And what were your recommendations?
I didn't have any. It was just something the State Department asked me to include as a possibility, so I did.
You didn't make any recommendations in your report?
No, Norman said. To tell you the truth, at the time, I thought the idea was a joke.
It's not, Barnes said. He sat down heavily, stared at the screen. What the hell are we going to do now?
Do not be afraid.
That's fine for him to say, listening to everything we say.
He looked at the screen.
Are you listening to us now, Jerry?
Yes, Hal.
What a mess,
Barnes said. Ted said, I think it's an exciting development.
Norman said, Jerry, can you read our minds?
Yes, Norman.
Oh, brother, Barnes said, he can read our minds.
Maybe not, Norman thought. He frowned, concentrating, and thought, Jerry, can you hear me? The screen remained blank. Jerry, tell me your name.
The screen did not change. Maybe a visual image, Norman thought. Perhaps he can receive a visual image.
Norman cast around in his mind for something to visualize. Chose a sandy tropical beach, then a palm tree. The image of the palm tree was clear, but then he thought Jerry wouldn't know what a palm tree was. It wouldn't mean anything to him. Norman thought he should choose something that might be within Jerry's experience.
He decided to imagine a planet with rings like Saturn. He frowned. Jerry, I am going to send you a picture. Tell me what you see. He focused his mind on the image of Saturn, a bright yellow sphere with a tilted ring system hanging in the blackness of space. He sustained the image about 10 seconds and then looked at the screen. The screen did not change. Jerry, are you there? The screen still did not change.
Jerry, are you there? Norman said.
Yes, Norman, I am here.
I don't think we should talk in this room, Barnes said. Maybe if we go into another cylinder and turn the water on.
Like in the spy movies?
It's worth a try.
Ted said, I think we're being unfair to Jerry. If we feel that he is intruding on our privacy, why don't we just tell him? Ask him not to intrude.
I do not wish to intrude.
Let's face it, Barnes said. This guy knows a lot more about us than we know about him.
Yes, I know many things about your entities.
Jerry, Ted said.
Yes, Ted, I am here.
Please leave us alone.
I do not wish to do so. I am happy to talk with you. I enjoy to talk with you. Let us talk now. I wish it.
It's obvious he won't listen to reason, Barnes said.
Jerry, Ted said, you must leave us alone for a while.
No, that is not possible. I do not agree. No.
Now the bastard's showing us true colors, Barnes said.
The child king, Norman thought.
Let me try.
Be my guest.
Jerry, Norman said.
Yes, Norman, I am here.
Jerry, it is very exciting for us to talk to you.
Thank you. I am excited also.
Jerry, we find you a fascinating and wonderful entity.
Barnes was rolling his eyes, shaking his head. Thank you, Norman.
And we wish to talk to you for many, many hours, Jerry.
Good.
We admire your gifts and talents.
Thank you.
And we know that you have great power and understanding of all things.
This is so, Norman. Yes.
Jerry, in your great understanding, you certainly know that we are entities who must have conversations among ourselves without your listening to us. The experience of meeting you is very challenging to us. And we have much to talk about among ourselves.
Barnes was shaking his head.
I have much to talk about also. I enjoy much to talk with your entities, Norman.
Yes, I know, Jerry. But you also know, in your wisdom, that we need to talk alone.
Do not be afraid.
We're not afraid, Jerry. We are uncomfortable.
Do not be uncomfortable.
We can't help it, Jerry. It is the way we are.
I enjoy much to talk with your entities, Norman. I am happy. Are you happy also?
Yes, very happy, Jerry. But you see, we need...
Good, I am glad.
We need to talk alone. Please do not listen for a while.
Am I offended you?
No, you are very friendly and charming, but we need to talk alone without your listening for a while.
I understand you need this. I wish you to have comfort with me, Norman. I shall grant what you desire.
Thank you, Jerry.
Sure, Barnes said. You think he'll really do it?
We'll be right back after a short break for these messages from our sponsor.
And the screen went blank. Despite himself, Norman laughed.
Fascinating, Ted said. Apparently he's been picking up television signals.
Can't do that from underwater.
We can't, but it looks like he can.
Barnes said,
I know he's still listening. I know he is. Jerry, are you there?
The screen was blank.
Jerry?
Nothing happened. The screen remained blank.
He's gone.
Well, Norman said, you've just seen the power of psychology in action. He couldn't help saying it. He was still annoyed with Ted. I'm sorry, Ted began. It's all right. But I just don't think that for a higher intellect, emotions are really significant. Let's not go into this again, Beth said. The real point, Norman said, is that emotions and intellect are entirely unrelated. They're like separate compartments of the brain, or even separate brains, and they don't communicate with each other. That's why intellectual understanding is so useless. Ted said, intellectual understanding is useless? He sounded horrified. In many cases, yes, Norman said. If you read a book on how to ride a bike, do you know how to ride a bike? No, you don't. You can read all you want, but you still have to go out and learn to ride. The part of your brain that learns to ride is different from the part of your brain that reads about it. What does this have to do with Jerry? Barnes said. We know, Norman said, that a smart person is just as likely to blunder emotionally as anyone else. If Jerry is really an emotional creature, and not just pretending to be one, then we need to deal with his emotional side as well as his intellectual side. Very convenient for you, Ted said. Not really, Norman said. Frankly, I'd be much happier if Jerry were just cold, emotionless intellect. Why? Because, Norman said, if Jerry is powerful and also emotional, it raises a question. What happens if Jerry gets mad? Levy. The group broke up. Harry, exhausted by the sustained effort of decoding, immediately went off to sleep. Ted went to Cecil to tape his personal observations on Jerry for the book he was planning to write. Barnes and Fletcher went to Esil to plan battle strategy in case the alien decided to attack them. Tina stayed for a moment, adjusting the monitors in her precise, methodical way. Norman and Beth watched her work. She spent a lot of time with a deck of controls Norman had never noticed before. There was a series of gas plasma readout screens, glowing bright red. What's all that? Beth said. EPSA, the External Perimeter Sensor Array. We have active and passive sensors for all modalities, thermal, aural, pressure wave, ranged in concentric circles around the habitat. Captain Barnes wants them all reset and activated. Why is that? Norman said. I don't know, sir. His orders. The intercom crackled. Barnes said, Seaman Chan to E-cylinder on the double, and shut down the comm line in here. I don't want that Jerry listening to these plans. Yes, sir. Beth said, paranoid ass. Tina collected her papers and hurried off. Norman sat with Beth in silence for a moment. They heard the rhythmic thumping from somewhere in the habitat. Then another silence. Then they heard the thumping again. What is that? Beth said. It sounds like it's somewhere inside the habitat. She went to the porthole, looked out, clicked on the exterior floods. Uh-oh, Beth said. Norman looked. Stretching across the ocean floor was an elongated shadow which moved back and forth with each thumping impact. The shadow was so distorted, it took him a moment to realize what he was seeing. It was the shadow of a human arm and a human hand. Captain Barnes, are you there? There was no reply. Norman snapped the intercom switch again. Captain Barnes, are you reading? Still no reply. He shut off the comm line, Beth said. He can't hear you. Do you think the person's still alive out there? Norman said. I don't know. They might be. Let's get going, Norman said. He tasted the dry metallic compressed air inside his helmet and felt the numbing cold of the water as he slid through the floor hatch and fell in darkness to the soft muddy bottom. Moments later, Beth landed just behind him. Okay, she said. Fine. I don't see any jellyfish, she said. No, neither do I. They moved out from beneath the habitat, turned, and looked back. The habitat lights shone harshly into their eyes, obscuring the outlines of the cylinders rising above. They could clearly hear the rhythmic thumping, but they still could not locate the source of the sound. They walked beneath the stanchions to the far side of the habitat, squinting into the lights.
There,
Beth said. 10 feet above them, a blue-suited figure was wedged in a light-stand bracket. The body moved loosely in the current, the bright yellow helmet banging intermittently against the wall of the habitat.
Can you see who it is? Beth said.
No. The lights were shining directly in his face. Norman climbed up one of the heavy supporting stanchions that anchored the habitat to the bottom. The metal surface was covered with a slippery brown algae. His boots kept sliding off the pipes until finally he saw that there were built-in indented footholds. Then he climbed easily. Now the feet of the body were swinging just above his head. Norman climbed another step, and one of the boots caught in the loop of the air hose that ran from his tank pack to his helmet. He reached behind his helmet, trying to free himself from the body. The body shivered, and for an awful moment he thought it was still alive. Then the boot came free in his hand, and a naked foot, gray flesh, purple toenails, kicked his face plate. A moment of nausea quickly passed. Norman had seen too many airplane crashes to be bothered by this. He dropped the boot, watched it drift down to Beth. He tugged on the leg of the corpse. He felt a mushy softness to the leg, and the body came free. It gently drifted down. He grabbed the shoulder, again feeling softness. He turned the body so he could see the face. It's Levy. Her helmet was filled with water. Behind the faceplate, he saw staring eyes, open mouth, an expression of horror.
I got her,
Beth said, pulling the body down. Then she said,
Jesus.
Norman climbed back down the stanchion. Beth was moving the body away from the habitat into the lighted area beyond.
She's all soft. It's like every bone in her body was broken.
I know. He moved out into the light, joined her. He felt a strange detachment, a coldness, and a remove. He had known this woman. She had been alive just a short time before. Now she was dead. But it was as if he were viewing it all from a great distance. He turned Levy's body over. On the left side was a long tear in the fabric of the suit. He had a glimpse of red, mangled flesh. Norman bent to inspect it. An accident?
I don't think so, Beth said.
Here, hold her. Norman lifted up the edges of suit fabric. Several separate tears met at a central point. It's actually torn in a star pattern, he said. You see?
She stepped back. I see, yes.
What would cause that, Beth?
I'm not sure.
Beth stepped farther back. Norman was looking into the tear at the body beneath the suit. The flesh is macerated.
Macerated?
Chewed.
Jesus.
Yes, definitely chewed, he thought, probing inside the tear. The wound was peculiar. There were fine, jagged serrations in the flesh. Thin, pale red trickles of blood drifted up past his faceplate.
Let's go back, Beth said.
Just hang on. Norman squeezed the body at legs, hips, shoulders, everywhere. It was soft, like a sponge. The body had been somehow almost entirely crushed. He could feel the leg bones, broken in many places. What could have done that? He went back to the wound. I don't like it out here, Beth said, tense. Just a second. At first inspection, he had thought Levy's wound represented some sort of bite, but now he wasn't sure. Her skin, Norman said. It's like a rough file has gone over it. He jerked his head back, startled, as something small and white drifted past his faceplate. His heart pounded at the thought that it was a jellyfish, but then he saw it was perfectly round and almost opaque. It was about the size of a golf ball. It drifted past him. He looked around. There were thin streaks of mucus in the water, and many white spheres. What are these, Beth?
Eggs.
Over the intercom, he heard her take deep, slow breaths.
Let's get out of here, Norman. Please.
Just another second.
No, Norman. Now.
On the radio, they heard an alarm. Distant and tinny, it seemed to be transmitted from inside the habitat. They heard voices, and then Barnes's voice, very loud.
What the hell are you doing out there?
We found Levy, Hal, Norman said.
Well, get back on the double, damn it,
Barnes said.
The sensors have activated. You're not alone out there. And whatever's with you is very damn big.
Norman felt dull and slow.
What about Levy's body? Drop the body. Get back here.
But the body, he thought sluggishly. They had to do something with the body. He couldn't just leave the body.
What's the matter with you, Norman?
Barnes said. Norman mumbled something, and he vaguely felt Beth grab him strongly by the arm, lead him back toward the habitat. The water was now clouded with white eggs. The alarms were ringing in his ears. The sound was very loud. And then he realized a new alarm. This alarm was ringing inside his suit. He began to shiver. His teeth chattered uncontrollably. He tried to speak, but bit his tongue, tasted blood. He felt numb and stupid. Everything was happening in slow motion. As they approached the habitat, he could see that the eggs were sticking to the cylinders, clinging densely, making a nubbly white surface.
Hurry! Barnes shouted. Hurry! It's coming this way!
They were under the airlock, and he began to feel surging currents of water. There was something very big out there. Beth was pushing him upward, and then his helmet burst above the waterline, and Fletcher gripped him with strong arms. And a moment after that, Beth was pulled up, and the hatch slammed shut. Somebody took off his helmet, and he heard the alarm shrieking loud in his ears. By now his whole body was shaking in spasms, thumping on the deck. They stripped off his suit and wrapped him in a silver blanket and held him until his shivering lessened, then finally stopped. And abruptly, despite the alarm, he went to sleep. Military considerations.
It's not your goddamn job, that's why, Barnes said. You had no authorization to do what you did. None whatsoever.
Levy might have still been alive, Beth said, calm in the face of Barnes's fury.
But she wasn't alive, and by going outside you risked the lives of 2 civilian expedition members unnecessarily.
Norman said, It was my idea, Hal. Norman was still wrapped in blankets, but they had given him hot drinks and made him rest, and now he felt better.
And you, Barnes said, you're lucky to be alive.
I guess I am, Norman said. But I don't know what happened.
This is what happened, Barnes said, waving a small fan in front of him. Your suit circulator shorted out, and you experienced rapid central cooling from the helium. Another couple of minutes, and you would have been dead.
It was so fast, Norman said.
I didn't realize... You goddamn people, Barnes said. I want to make something clear. This is not a scientific conference. This is not the underwater Holiday Inn, where you can do whatever you please. This is a military operation, and you will damn well follow military orders. Is that clear?
This is a military operation? Ted said.
It is now, Barnes said.
Wait a minute. Was it always?
It is now.
You haven't answered the question, Ted said. Because if it is a military operation, I think we need to know that. I personally do not wish to be associated with...
Then leave, Beth said.
A military operation that is...
Look, Ted, Barnes said. You know what this is costing the Navy?
No, but I don't see...
I'll tell you.
A deep placement, saturated gas environment with full support runs about $100,000 an hour. By the time we all get out of here, the total project cost will be $80 to $100 million.
You don't get that kind of appropriations from the military without what they call a serious expectation of military benefit. It's that simple. No expectation, no money. You following me?
You mean like a weapon? Beth said.
Possibly, yes, Barnes said.
Well, Ted said, I personally would never have joined...
Is that right? You'd fly all the way to Tonga, and I'd say, Ted, there's a spacecraft down there that might contain life from another galaxy, but it's a military operation, and you'd say, gosh, sorry to hear that. Count me out. Is that what you'd have done, Ted?
Well, Ted said,
then you better shut up, Barnes said,
because I've had it with your posturing.
Hear, hear, Beth said.
I personally feel you're overwrought, Ted said.
I personally feel you're an egomaniacal asshole, Burns said.
Just a minute, everybody, Harry said. Does anybody know why Levy went outside in the first place?
Tina said she was on a TRL.
A what?
A time clock required lockout, Barnes said. It's the duty schedule. Levy was Edmonds's backup. After Edmonds died, it became Levy's job to go to the submarine every 12 hours.
Go to the sub? Why? Harry said.
Barnes pointed out the porthole. You see DH-7 over there? Well, next to the single cylinder is an inverted dome hangar, and beneath the dome is a mini-sub that the divers left behind. In a situation like this, Barnes said, Navy regs require that all tapes and records be transferred to the sub every 12 hours. The sub is on TBDR mode, timed ballast drop and release, set on a timer every 12 hours. That way, if somebody doesn't get there every 12 hours, transfer the latest tapes and press the yellow delay button, the sub will automatically drop ballast, blow tanks, and go to the surface unattended.
Why is that?
If there's a disaster down here, say something happened to all of us, then the sub would automatically surface after 12 hours with all the tapes accumulated thus far. The Navy'd recover the sub at the surface, and they'd have at least a partial record of what happened to us down here.
I see. The sub's our flight recorder.
You could say that, yes, but it's also our way out, our only emergency exit.
So Levy was going to the sub?
Yes, and she must have made it because the sub is still here.
She transferred the tapes, pressed the delay button, and then she died on the way back.
Yes.
How did she die?
Harry said, looking carefully at Barnes. We're not sure, Barnes said.
Her entire body was crushed, Norman said. It was like a sponge.
Harry said to Barnes,
An hour ago you ordered the EPSA sensors to be reset and adjusted. Why was that?
We had gotten a strange reading in the previous hour.
What sort of a reading?
Something out there, something very large.
But it didn't trigger the alarms, Harry said.
No, this thing was beyond alarm set parameters.
You mean it was too big to set off the alarms?
Yes. After the first false alarm, the settings were all cranked down. The alarms were set to ignore anything that large. That's why Tina had to readjust the settings.
And what set off the alarms just now? Harry said,
when Beth and Norman were out there.
Barnes said,
Tina?
I don't know what it was. Some kind of animal, I guess.
Silent and very big.
How big?
She shook her head.
From the electronic footprint, Dr. Adams, I would say the thing was almost as big as this habitat.
Battle stations. Beth slipped one round white egg onto the stage of the scanning microscope.
Well, she said, peering through the eyepiece, it's definitely marine invertebrate.
The interesting feature is this slimy coating.
She poked at it with forceps.
What is it?
Norman said.
Some kind of proteinaceous material, sticky.
No, I mean, what is the egg?
Don't know yet.
Beth continued her examination when the alarm sounded and the red lights began to flash again. Norman felt a sudden dread.
Probably another false alarm, Beth said.
Attention all hands, Barnes said on the intercom. All hands, battle stations.
Oh, shit, Beth said.
Beth slid gracefully down the ladder as if it were a fire pole. Norman followed clumsily back down behind her. At the communications section on D-Sill, he found a familiar scene. Everyone clustered around the computer, and the back panels again removed. The light still flashed, the alarm still shrieked.
What is it?
Norman shouted.
Equipment breakdown.
What equipment breakdown?
We can't turn the damn alarm off, Barnes shouted.
It turned it on, but we can't turn it off.
Teeny.
Working on it, sir.
The big engineer was crouched behind the computer. Norman saw the broad curve of her back.
Get that damn thing off.
Getting it off, sir.
Get it off. I can't hear.
Hear what? Norman wondered.
And then Harry stumbled into the room, colliding with Norman.
Jesus!
This is an emergency, Barnes was shouting. This is an emergency. Seaman Chan, sonar! Tina was next to him, calm as always, adjusting dials on side monitors. She slipped on headphones. Norman looked at the sphere on the video monitor. The sphere was closed. Beth went to one of the portholes and looked closely at the white material that blocked it. Barnes spun like a dervish beneath the flashing red lights, shouting, swearing in all directions. And then suddenly the alarm stopped, and the red lights stopped flashing. Everyone was silent. Fletcher straightened and sighed. Harry said, "I thought you got that fixed."
"Shh."
They heard the soft, repetitive pong of the sonar impulses. Tina cupped her hands over the headphones, frowning, concentrating. Nobody moved or spoke. They stood tensely, listening to the sonar as it echoed back. Barnes said quietly to the group, "A few minutes ago we got a signal from outside. Something very large." Finally, Tina said,
"I'm not getting it now, sir."
"Go passive."
"Aye, aye, sir. Going passive."
The pinging sonar stopped. In its place, they heard a slight hiss. Tina adjusted the speaker volume. "Hydrophones?" Harry said quietly. Barnes nodded. "Polar glass transducers. Best in the world." They all strained to listen, but heard nothing except the undifferentiated hiss. To Norman, it sounded like tape noise, with an occasional gurgle of the water. If he wasn't so tense, he would have found the sound irritating. Barnes said, "Bastard's clever. He's managed to blind us, cover all our ports with goo."
"Not goo," Beth said. "Eggs."
"Well, they're covering every damn port in the habitat." The hissing continued, unchanging. Tina twisted the hydrophone dials. There was a soft, continuous crackling, like cellophane being crumpled.
"What's that?" Ted said.
Beth said, "Fish. Eating." Barnes nodded. Tina twisted the dials, tuning it out. They again heard the undifferentiated hiss. The tension in the room lessened. Norman felt tired and sat down. Harry sat next to him. Norman noticed that Harry looked more thoughtful than concerned. Across the room, Ted stood near the hatch door and bit his lip. He looked like a frightened kid. There was a soft electronic beep. Lines on the gas plasma screens jumped. Tina said, "I have a positive on peripheral thermals." Barnes nodded. "Direction?"
"East. Coming."
They heard a metallic clank, then another clank.
"What's that?"
"The grid. He's hitting the grid."
"Hitting it? Sounds like he's dismantling it."
Norman remembered the grid. It was made of 3-inch pipe.
"A big fish? A shark?" Beth said.
Barnes shook his head. "He's not moving like a shark, and he's too big." Tina said, "Positive thermals on inline perimeter. He's still coming." Barnes said, "Go active." The pong of the sonar echoed in the room. Tina said, "Target acquired, 100 yards. Image him." "FAS on, sir." There was a rapid succession of sonar sounds. Pong, 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 pong. Then a pause, and it came again. Pong, 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 pong. Norman looked puzzled. Fletcher leaned over and whispered, "False aperture sonar makes a detailed picture from several senders outside. Gives you a good look at him." He smelled liquor on her breath. He thought, "Where'd she get liquor?" Pong, 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 pong. "Building image, 90 yards. Pong, 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 pong.
Image up."
They turned to the screens. Norman saw an amorphous, streaky blob. It didn't mean much to him.
"Jesus," Barnes said. "Look at the size of him."
Pong, 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 pong. 80 yards. Pong, 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 pong. Another image appeared. Now the blob was a different shape. The streaks in another direction. The image was sharper at the edges, but it still meant nothing to Norman. A big blob with streaks.
"Jesus, he's got to be 30-40 feet across," Barnes said.
"No fish in the world is that big," Beth said. whale. It's not a whale.
Norman saw that Harry was sweating. Harry took off his glasses and wiped them on his jumpsuit. Then he put them back on and pushed them up on the bridge of his nose. They slipped back down. He glanced at Norman and shrugged.
Tina, 50 yards in closing.
Pong, 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 pong.
30 yards.
Pong, 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 pong.
30 yards.
Pong, 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 pong.
Holding at 30 yards, sir.
Pong, 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 pong.
Still holding.
Active off.
Once again, they heard the hiss of the hydrophones. Then a distinct clicking sound.
Norman's eyes burned. Sweat had rolled into his eyes. He wiped his forehead with his jumpsuit sleeve. The others were sweating, too. The tension was unbearable. He glanced at the video monitor again. The sphere was still closed. He heard the hiss of the hydrophones. A soft scraping sound, like a heavy sack being dragged across a wooden floor. Then the hiss again. Tina whispered, "Want to image him again?"
"No,"
Barnes said. They listened. More scraping. A moment of silence, followed by the gurgle of water, very loud, very close.
"Jesus," Barnes whispered. "He's right outside."
A dull thump against the side of the habitat. The screen flashed on. "I am here." The first impact came suddenly, knocking them off their feet. They tumbled, rolling on the floor. All around them, the habitat creaked and groaned, the sounds frighteningly loud. Norman scrambled to his feet. He saw Fletcher bleeding from her forehead. And the second impact hit. Norman was thrown sideways against the bulkhead. There was a metallic clang as his head struck metal, a sharp pain, and then Barnes landed on top of him, grunting and cursing. Barnes pushed his hand in Norman's face as he struggled to his feet. Norman slid back to the floor, and a video monitor crashed alongside him, spitting sparks. By now, the habitat was swaying like a building in an earthquake. They clutched consoles, panels, doorways to keep their balance. But it was the noise that Norman found most frightening, the incredibly loud metallic groans and cracks as the cylinders were shaken on their moorings. The creature was shaking the entire habitat. Barnes was on the far side of the room, trying to make his way to the bulkhead door. He had a bleeding gash along one arm, and he was shouting orders, but Norman couldn't hear anything except the terrifying sound of rending metal. He saw Fletcher squeeze through the bulkhead, and then Tina, and then Barnes made it through, leaving behind a bloody handprint on the metal. Norman couldn't see Harry, but Beth lurched toward him, holding her hand out, saying, "Norman, Norman, we have to..." And then she slammed into him, and he was knocked over, and he fell onto the carpet underneath the couch and slid up against the cold outer wall of the cylinder. And he realized with horror that the carpet was wet. The habitat was leaking. He had to do something. He struggled back to his feet and stood right in a fine, sizzling spray from one of the wall seams. He glanced around, saw other leaks spurting from the ceiling, the walls. This place is going to be torn apart. Beth grabbed him, pulled her head close. "We're leaking," she shouted. "God, we're leaking!" "I know," Norman said, and Barnes shouted over the intercom, "Positive pressure, get positive pressure." Norman saw Ted on the floor just before he tripped over him and fell heavily against the computer consoles, his face near the screen, the glowing letters large before him. "Do not be afraid."
"Jerry!"
Ted was shouting.
"Stop this, Jerry! Jerry!"
Suddenly, Harry's face was next to Ted, glasses askew.
"Save your breath. He's going to kill us all."
"He doesn't understand,"
Ted shouted, as he fell backward onto the couch, flailing arms. The powerful wrenching of metal on metal continued without pause, throwing Norman from one side to the other. He kept reaching for handholds, but his hands were wet, and he couldn't seem to grasp anything.
"Now hear this," Barnes said over the intercom. "Chan and I are going outside. Fletcher assumes command."
"Don't go out," Harry shouted. "Don't go out there."
"Opening hatch now," Barnes said laconically. "Tina, you follow me."
"You'll be killed,"
Harry shouted, and then he was thrown against Beth. Norman was on the floor again. He banged his head on one of the couch legs.
"We're outside,"
Barnes said, and abruptly the banging stopped. The habitat was motionless.
They did not move. With the water streaming in through a dozen fine, misty leaks, they looked up at the intercom speaker and listened.
"Clear of the hatch," Barnes said. "Our status is good. Armament, J-9 exploding head spears loaded with Taglin 50 charges. We'll show this bastard a trick or two."
Silence.
"Water. Visibility is poor. Visibility under 5 feet. Seems to be stirred up bottom sediment and very black, dark, feeling our way along buildings."
Silence.
"North side, going east now. Tina?"
Silence.
"Tina?"
"Behind you, sir."
"All right, put your hand on my tank so you..." "Good, okay."
Silence. Inside the cylinder, Ted sighed. "I don't think they should kill it," he said softly. Norman thought, "I don't think they can." Nobody else said anything. They listened to the amplified breathing of Barnes and Tina.
"Northeast corner." "All right. Feel strong currents. Active, moving water. Something nearby. Can't see. Visibility less than 5 feet. Can barely see stanchion I am holding. I can feel him, though. He's big. He's near. Tina?"
Silence. A loud, sharp crackling sound. Static. Then silence.
"Tina? Tina?"
Silence.
"I've lost Tina."
Another very long silence.
"I don't know what a..." "Tina, if you can hear me, stay where you are. I'll take it from here." "Okay. He is very close. I feel him moving. Pushes a lot of water, this guy. A real monster."
Silence again.
"Wish I could see better."
Silence.
"Tina, is that..." And then a muffled thud that might have been an explosion. They all looked at each other, trying to know what the sound meant. But in the next instant, the habitat began rocking and wrenching again, and Norman, unprepared, was slammed sideways against the sharp edge of the bulkhead door, and the world went gray. He saw Harry strike the wall next to him, and Harry's glasses fell onto Norman's chest, and Norman reached for the glasses for Harry, because Harry needed his glasses. And then Norman lost consciousness, and everything was black. After the attack, hot spray poured over him, and he inhaled steam. Standing in the shower, Norman looked down at his body and thought, "I look like a survivor of an airplane crash. One of those people I used to see and marvel that they were still alive." The lumps on his head throbbed. His chest was scraped raw in a great swath down to his abdomen. His left thigh was purple-red. His right hand was swollen and painful. But then everything was painful. He groaned, turning his face up to the water. "Hey," Harry called, "how about it in there?" "Okay." Norman stepped out, and Harry climbed in. Scrapes and bruises covered his thin body. Norman looked over at Ted, who lay on his back in one of the bunks. Ted had dislocated both shoulders, and it had taken Beth half an hour to get them back in, even after she'd shot him up with morphine. "How is it now?" Norman said to him.
"Okay."
Ted had a numb, dull expression. His ebullience was gone. He had sustained a greater injury than the dislocated shoulders, Norman thought. In many ways a naive child, Ted must have been profoundly shocked to discover that this alien intelligence was hostile. "Hurt much?" Norman said.
"It's okay."
Norman sat slowly on his bunk, feeling pain streak up his spine. 53 years old, he thought. "I should be playing golf." Then he thought, "I should be just about anywhere in the world except here." He winced and gingerly slipped a shoe over his injured right foot. For some reason, he remembered Levy's bare toes, the skin color dead, the foot striking his faceplate. "Did they find Barnes?" Ted asked.
"I haven't heard," Norman said. "I don't think so."
He finished dressing and went down to D-Sill, stepping over the puddles of water in the corridor. Inside D itself, the furniture was soaked.
The consoles were wet, and the walls were covered with irregular blobs of white urethane foam where Fletcher had spray-sealed the cracks. Fletcher stood in the middle of the room, the spray can in hand.
"Not as pretty as it was," she said.
"Will it hold?"
"Sure, but I guarantee you, we can't survive another one of those attacks."
"What about the electronics? Are they working?"
"I haven't checked, but it should be okay. It's all waterproofed."
Norman nodded. "Any sign of Captain Barnes?" He looked at the bloody handprint on the wall.
"No, sir.
No sign of the captain at all." Fletcher followed his eyes to the wall. "I'll clean the place up in a minute, sir." "Where's Tina?" Norman asked.
"Resting in Esil."
Norman nodded.
"Esil any drier than this?"
"Yes," Fletcher said.
"It's a funny thing. There was nobody in Esil during the attack, and it stayed completely dry."
"Any word from Jerry?"
"No contact, sir, no."
Norman flicked on one of the computer consoles. "Jerry, are you there?" The screen remained blank. "Jerry?" He waited a moment, then turned the console off. Tina said, "Look at it now." She sat up and drew the blanket back to expose her left leg. The injury was much worse than when they had heard her screaming and had run through the habitat and pulled her up through the ASIL hatch. Now, running diagonally down her leg was a series of saucer-shaped welts, the center of each puffed and purple.
"It's swollen a lot in the last hour," Tina said.
Norman examined the injuries. Fine tooth marks ringed swollen areas.
"Do you remember what it felt like?" he said. "It felt awful," Tina said. "It felt sticky, you know, like sticky glue or something. And then each one of these round places burned very strong."
"And what could you see of the creature itself?"
"It was a long, flat spatula thing. It looked like a giant leaf. It came out and wrapped around me."
"Any color?"
"Sort of brownish. I couldn't really see."
He paused a moment. "And Captain Barnes?"
"During the course of the action, I was separated from Captain Barnes, sir. I don't know what happened to Captain Barnes, sir."
Tina spoke formally, her face a mask. He thought, "Let's not go into this now. If you ran away, it's all right with me." "Has Beth seen this injury, Tina?"
"Yes, sir. She was here a few minutes ago."
"Okay, just rest now."
"Sir?"
"Yes, Tina."
"Who will be making the report, sir?"
"I don't know. Let's not worry about reports now. Let's just concentrate on getting through this."
"Yes, sir."
As he approached Beth's lab, he heard Tina's recorded voice say, "Do you think they'll ever get the sphere open?" Beth said, "Maybe. I don't know.
It scares me."
And then Tina's voice came again. "Do you think they'll ever get the sphere open?"
"Maybe. I don't know. It scares me."
In the lab, Beth was hunched over the console, watching the tape.
"Still at it, huh?" Norman said.
"Yeah." On the tape, Beth was finishing her cake, saying, "I don't think there's a reason to be scared."
"It's the unknown," Tina said.
"Sure," Beth said on screen. "But an unknown thing is not likely to be dangerous or frightening. It's most likely to be just inexplicable." "Famous last words," Beth said, watching herself. "It sounded good at the time," Norman said, to keep her calm down. On screen, Beth said to Tina, "You afraid of snakes?"
"Snakes don't bother me," Tina said.
"Well, I can't stand snakes," Beth said. Beth stopped the tape, turned to Norman.
"Seems like a long time ago, doesn't it?"
"I was just thinking that," Norman said. "Does this mean we're living life to the fullest?" "I think it means we're in mortal peril," Norman said.
"Why are you so interested in this tape?"
"Because I have nothing better to do, and if I don't keep busy, I'm going to start screaming and make one of those traditional feminine scenes. You've already seen me do it once, Norman."
"Have I? I don't remember any scene."
"Thank you," she said.
Norman noticed a blanket on a couch in the corner of her lab, and Beth had unclipped one of the workbench lamps and mounted it on the wall above the blankets. You sleeping here now?
Yeah, I like it here. Up at the top of the cylinder. I feel like the queen of the underworld, she smiled. Sort of like a treehouse when you were a kid. Did you ever have a treehouse when you were a kid?
No, Norman said. I never did.
Neither did I, Beth said. But it's what I imagine it would be if I had.
Looks very cozy, Beth.
You think I'm cracking up?
No, I just said it looks cozy.
You can tell me if you think I'm cracking up.
I think you're fine, Beth. What about Tina? You've seen her injury?
Yes,
Beth frowned. And I've seen these. She gestured to some white eggs in a glass container on the lab bench. More eggs?
They were clinging to Tina's suit when she came back in. Her injury is consistent with these eggs. Also the smell. You remember the smell when we pulled her back in?
Norman remembered very well. Tina had smelled strongly of ammonia. It was almost as if she'd been doused in smelling salts.
Beth said, as far as I know, there's only one animal that smells of ammonia that way. Architeuthis sanctipauli.
Which is?
One of the species of giant squid.
That's what attacked us?
I think so, yes.
She explained that little was known about the giant squid because the only specimens studied were dead animals that washed ashore, generally in a state of advanced decay and reeking of ammonia. For most of human history, the giant squid was considered a mythical sea monster, like the kraken. But in 1861, the first reliable scientific reports appeared after a French warship managed to haul in fragments of one dead animal. And many killed whales, which showed scars from giant suckers, testimony of undersea battles. Whales were the only known predator of the giant squid, the only animals large enough to be predators.
By now, Beth said, giant squid have been observed in every major ocean of the world. There are at least three distinct species. The animals grow very large and can weigh 1,000 pounds or more. The head is about 20 feet long, with a crown of 8 arms. Each arm is about 10 feet long, with long rows of suckers. In the center of the crown is a mouth with a sharp beak, like a parrot's beak, except the jaws are 7 inches long.
Daniels' torn suit?
Yes, she nodded. The beak is mounted in a ring of muscles so it can twist in circles as it bites. And the radula, the tongue of the squid, has a raspy, file-like surface.
Tina mentioned something about a leaf, a brown leaf.
The giant squid has 2 tentacles that extend out much further than the arms, as long as 40 feet. Each tentacle ends in a flattened manus, or palm, which looks very much like a big leaf. The manus is what the squid really uses to catch prey. The suckers on the manus are surrounded by a little hard ring of chitin, which is why you see the circular tooth marks around the injury.
Norman said, "How would you fight one?"
"Well," Beth said, "in theory, although giant squid are very large, they are not particularly strong."
"So much for theory," Norman said. She nodded. "Of course, nobody knows how strong they are, since a living specimen has never been encountered. We have the dubious distinction of being first."
"But it can be killed?"
"I would think rather easily. The squid's brain is located behind the eye, which is about 15 inches across, the size of a big dinner plate. If you directed an explosive charge into the animal anywhere in that area, you would almost certainly disrupt the nervous system and it would die."
"Do you think Barnes killed the squid?"
She shrugged.
"I don't know."
"Is there more than one in an area?"
"I don't know."
"Will we see one again?"
"I don't know."
The Visitor. Norman went downstairs to the communications center to see if he could talk to Jerry, but Jerry was not responding. Norman must have dozed off in the console chair, because he looked up abruptly, startled to see a trim black seaman in uniform standing just behind him, looking over his shoulder at the screens.
"How's it going, sir?"
the seaman asked. He was very calm. His uniform was crisply pressed. Norman felt a burst of tremendous elation. This man's arrival at the habitat could mean only one thing. The surface ships must be back. The ships had returned, and the subs had been sent down to retrieve them. They were all going to be saved. "Sailor," Norman said, pumping his hand, "I'm very damn glad to see you."
"Thank you, sir."
"When did you get here?" Norman asked.
"Just now, sir."
"Do the others know yet?"
"The others, sir?"
"Yes, there's six of us left. Have they been told you're here?"
"I don't know the answer to that, sir." There was a flatness to this man that Norman found odd. The sailor was looking around the habitat, and for a moment Norman saw the environment through his eyes, the damp interior, the wrecked consoles, the foam-spattered walls. It looked like they had fought a war in here.
"We've had a rough time," Norman said.
"I can see that, sir.
Three of us have died."
"I'm sorry to hear that, sir."
That flatness again, neutrality, was he being proper? Was he worried about a pending court-martial? Was it something else entirely?
"Where have you come from?" Norman said.
"Come from, sir?"
"What ship?"
"Oh, the Sea Hornet, sir."
"It's topside now?"
"Yes, sir, it is."
"Well, let's get moving," Norman said. "Tell the others you're here."
"Yes, sir."
The seaman went away. Norman stood and shouted, "Yahoo! We're saved!"
"At least he wasn't an illusion," Norman said, staring at the screen.
"There he is, big as life, on the monitor."
"Yes, there he is, but where'd he go?" Beth said.
For the last hour, they had searched the habitat thoroughly. There was no sign of the black crewman. There was no sign of a submarine outside. There was no evidence of surface ships. The balloon they had sent up registered 80-knot winds and 30-foot waves before the wire snapped.
So where had he come from?
And where had he gone?
Fletcher was working the consoles. A screen of data came up.
"How about this? Log of ships in active service shows no vessel currently designated Sea Hornet."
Norman said, "What the hell is going on here?"
"Maybe he was an illusion," Ted said.
"Illusions don't register on videotape," Harry said. "Besides, I saw him too."
"You did?"
Norman said.
"Yeah, I had just woken up and I had had this dream about being rescued, and I was lying in bed when I heard footsteps and he walked into the room."
"Did you talk to him?"
"Yes, but he was funny. He was dull, kind of boring."
Norman nodded.
"You could tell something wasn't right about him."
"Yes, you could." "But where did he come from?" Beth said.
"I can think of only one possibility," Ted said. "He came from the sphere, or at least he was made by the sphere, by Jerry."
"Why would Jerry do that, to spy on us?" Ted shook his head.
"I've been thinking about this," he said. "It seems to me that Jerry has the ability to create things, animals. I don't think that Jerry is a giant squid, but Jerry created the giant squid that attacked us. I don't think Jerry wants to attack us, but from what Beth was telling us, once he made the squid, then the squid might attack the habitat, thinking the cylinders were its mortal enemy, the whale. So the attack happened as a kind of accident of creation."
They frowned, listening. To Norman, the explanation was entirely too convenient.
"I think there is another possibility, that Jerry is hostile."
"I don't believe that," Ted said. "I don't believe Jerry is hostile."
"He certainly acts hostile, Ted."
"But I don't think he intends to be hostile."
"Whatever he intends," Fletcher said, "we better not go through another attack, because the structure can't take it, and neither can the support systems. After the first attack, I had to increase positive pressure," Fletcher said, "in order to fix the leaks. To keep water from coming in, I had to increase the pressure of the air inside the habitat to make it greater than the pressure of the water outside. That stopped the leaks, but it meant that air bubbled out through all the cracks. And 1 hour of repair work consumed nearly 16 hours of our reserve air. I've been worried we'll run out of air."
There was a pause. They all considered the implications of that.
"To compensate," Fletcher said, "I've dropped the internal pressure by 3 centimeters pressure.
We're slightly negative right now, and we should be fine. Our air will last us.
But another attack under these conditions, and we'll crush like a beer can.
Norman didn't like hearing any of this, but at the same time he was impressed with Fletcher's competence.
She was a resource they ought to be using, he thought.
Do you have any suggestions, Teeny, if there's another attack?
Well, we have something in Sil B called HVDS.
Which is?
High Voltage Defense System. There's a little box in B that electrifies the metal walls of the cylinders at all times to prevent electrolytic corrosion.
Very slight electrical charge, you aren't really aware of it. Anyway, there's another green box attached to that one, and it's the HVDS. It's basically a low-amp step-up transformer that sends 2 million volts over the cylinder surface. Should be very unpleasant for any animal.
Why didn't we use it before? Beth said.
Why didn't Barnes use it instead of risking...
Because the green box has problems, Fletcher said. For one thing, it's really sort of theoretical. As far as I know, it's never actually been used in a real undersea work situation.
Yes, but it must have been tested.
Yes, and in all the tests, it started fires inside the habitat.
Another pause while they considered that. Finally, Norman said, "Bad fires?"
The fires tend to burn the insulation, the wall padding.
The fires take the padding off.
We'd die of heat loss in a few minutes.
Beth said, "How bad can a fire be? Fires need oxygen to burn, and we've only got 2% oxygen down here."
"That's true, Dr. Halpern," Fletcher said. "But the actual oxygen percentage varies. The habitat is made to deliver pulses as high as 16% for brief periods, 4 times an hour. It's all automatically controlled. You can't override it. And if the oxygen percentage is high, then fires burn just fine. 3 times faster than topside. They easily go out of control."
Norman looked around the cylinder. He spotted 3 fire extinguishers mounted on the walls. Now that he thought about it, there were extinguishers all over the habitat. He just never really paid attention before.
"Even if we get the fires under control, they're hell on the systems," Fletcher said. "The air handlers aren't made to take the added monoxide byproducts and soot."
"So what do we do?"
"Last resort only," Fletcher said. "That'd be my recommendation."
The group looked at each other, nodded.
"Okay," Norman said.
"Last resort only.
Let's just hope we don't have another attack."
Another attack. There was a long silence as they considered that. Then the gas plasma screens on Tina's console jumped, and a soft pinging filled the room.
"We have a contact on peripheral thermals," Tina said in a flat voice.
"Where?" Fletcher said.
"North, approaching."
And on the monitor, they saw the words, "I am coming." They turned off both the interior and exterior lights. Norman peered through the porthole, straining to see out in the darkness. He had long ago learned that the darkness at this depth was not absolute. The waters of the Pacific were so clear that even 1,000 feet down, some light registered on the bottom. It was very slight. Edmonds had compared it to starlight. But Norman knew that on the surface, you could see by starlight alone. Now he cupped his hands by the sides of his face to block out the low light coming from Tina's consoles, waited for his eyes to adjust. Behind him, Tina and Fletcher were working with the monitors. He heard the hiss of the hydrophones in the room. It was all happening again. Ted was standing by the monitor saying, "Jerry, can you hear me? Jerry, are you listening?" But he wasn't getting through. Beth came up as Norman peered out the porthole. "You see anything?"
"Not yet."
Behind them, Tina said, 80 yards in closing.
60 yards. You want sonar?"
"No sonar," Fletcher said. "Nothing to make ourselves interesting to him."
"Then should we kill the electronics?"
"Kill everything." All the console lights went out. Now there was just the red glow of the space heaters above them. They sat in darkness and stared out. Norman tried to remember how long dark vision accommodation required. He remembered it might be as long as 3 minutes. He began to see shapes, the outline of the grid on the bottom, and dimly the high fin of the spaceship rising sharply up. Then, something else. A green glow in the distance, at the horizon. "It's like a green sunrise," Beth said. The glow increased in intensity, and then they saw an amorphous green shape with lateral streaks. Norman thought, "It's just like the image we saw before. It looks just like that." He couldn't really make out the details. "Is it a squid?" he said. "Yes," Beth said. "I can't see. You're looking at it end on. The body is toward us, the tentacles behind, partially blocked by the body. That's why you can't see it." The squid grew larger. It was definitely coming toward them. Ted ran from the portholes back to the consoles. "Jerry, are you listening? Jerry?" "The electronics are off, Dr. Fielding," Fletcher said. "Well, let's try and talk to him, for God's sake." "I think we're past the talking stage now, sir." The squid was faintly luminous, the entire body a deep green. Now Norman could see a sharp vertical ridge in the body. The moving tentacles and arms were clear. The outline grew larger. The squid moved laterally. "It's going around the grid." "Yes," Beth said. "They're intelligent animals. They have the ability to learn from experience. It probably didn't like hitting the grid before, and it remembers." The squid passed the spacecraft fin, and they could gauge its size. "It's as big as a house," Norman thought. The creature slid smoothly through the water toward them. He felt a sense of awe despite his pounding heart. "Jerry! Jerry!" "Save your breath, Ted." 30 yards, Tina said. "Still coming." As the squid came closer, Norman could count the arms, and he saw the two long tentacles, glowing lines extending far beyond the body. The arms and tentacles seemed to move loosely in the water, while the body made rhythmic muscular contractions. The squid propelled itself with water and did not use the arms for swimming. 20 yards. "God, it's big," Harry said. "You know," Beth said, "we're the first people in human history to see a free-swimming giant squid. This should be a great moment." They heard the gurgling, the rush of water over the hydrophones, as the squid came closer. 10 yards. For a moment, the great creature turned sideways to the habitat, and they could see its profile, the enormous glowing body, 30 feet long, with the huge, unblinking eye, the circle of arms waving like evil snakes, the two long tentacles, each terminating in a flattened... stretched toward the habitat, and they glimpsed the mouth, the sharp-edged, chomping beak in a mass of glowing green muscle. Oh, God. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.